This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
A musical adaptation of Candide by one of America's most marvelous composers, Leonard Bernstein, who's probably best known for that wonderful version of Romeo and Juliet. That he used it about the same time as this, a great musical. Well, he did an adaptation of Candide that was performed back in 1956 in New York, and it really bombed big time. It closed after, I think, something like 70 performances or so. It was directed by the same man who directed that production that Professor McCall showed you part of, the Oedipus the King, a man called Tyrone Guthrie. And Tyrone Guthrie, who directed the original version of this, called it an artistic and financial disaster. And it really was. But more recently, over the last 10 years or so, it's frequently been revived in a variety of different venues all over the country. And if you get a chance to see it, it's really worthwhile. Its libretto is very interesting. It was the product of at least three really talented people. The well-known playwright, American playwright, Lillian Hellman, whose Little Foxes was on recently in San Francisco with the ACT. Bernstein himself contributed several of the lyrics, and the great poet and translator, Richard Wilbur, also wrote a number of them. So it's a very, very interesting adaptation of the text you've been reading. And if you get a chance to see it, I really would encourage you to do that. All right. In 1759, over 150 years after Shakespeare's Hamlet first saw the light of day, a book was published, and there it is up on the screen, the original title page. A book that explored virtually all the themes that we have dealt with in this course, and that's why it is the last text that we're dealing with. Like The Last Days of Socrates and The Consolation of Philosophy, it explored the nature of justice and the problem of evil. Like Sophocles' Oedipus the King and Shakespeare's Hamlet, it portrays the nature of fate and the search for knowledge. And finally, like Virgil's Aeneid, it traced in a kind of mock epic form the wanderings of a hero who has been exiled from his home and who, after many, many adventures in a variety of different places, ultimately settles in a foreign land far away from his native birthplace. But as we'll soon see, it's a work that confronts a crisis even more fundamental, even more disturbing than those we have examined in the course so far. And that crisis, of course, is the apparently random and meaningless destruction of tens of thousands of human beings. Now, Voltaire, the author, there's a rather revealing portrait of him, I think, with the faint smile hovering around his lips there. Voltaire was probably better qualified than many people to deal with the theme of human suffering, because his own life was absolutely packed with violent quarrels, unhappy love affairs, brief imprisonments, public disputes, and a lengthy exile, all. He was born in 1694, right at the end of the 17th century, to middle-class French parents who sent him to be educated at a very fine Jesuit school in Paris, where Voltaire studied the traditional subjects of an 18th century education in the liberal arts, namely the history, literature, the languages, and the philosophy of ancient Greece and Rome. No physics, no biology, no political science, no geography, no modern literature, just classical philosophy, literature, history, and language. His father had entertained the hope that Voltaire would eventually pursue a career in the law, but Voltaire himself had quite different ideas. He decided that he was going to be a writer, and he very soon in his life, very early in his life, carved out for himself a rather considerable reputation as a satirist, a writer of satires. Now, the mere fact that he chose to pursue that particular branch of literature is no accident, I think, because the fact is that both in France and in England, the 18th century was the great age of satire. If you just think on the most familiar English authors of that period, Jonathan Swift, Alexander Pope, Henry Fielding, William Congreve, Richard Sheridan, all of them were most famous for the satires, the satirical works that they composed, whether in prose, like Swift's great Gulliver's Travels, and Fielding's marvelous novel, Tom Jones, whether in verse, like Pope's Rape of the Lock, or in dramatic dialogue, like Congreve's The Way of the World and Sheridan's The School for Scandal. Now, this raises what I think is an interesting question, and that is just why? Why should this be so? Why should this particular century, this particular period, of all periods, have been the great age of satire? Well, my own view, for what it's worth, is that satire tends to flourish in proportion to the stability and the outward prosperity of any given time and place. In other words, satire is essentially a reaction against the complacency, the smugness, the self-confidence that all too often develop in periods of exceptional affluence and national success. Satire, in other words, is a way of pricking the inflated balloon of self-congratulation that appears on the scene when everything, it seems, is going really well. Now, satirists, of course, are not particularly popular. Especially, they're not popular with the people and the institutions which they satirize. And Voltaire's satirical genius, because it really was genius, often got him into quite serious trouble. He was twice imprisoned in the infamous prison, the Bastille, in Paris, the equivalent of Sing Sing that Professor McCall was talking about last time, when he was put there for poking fun at various members of the French aristocracy. In 1726, he was then exiled from France completely for a period of 3 years to England, a country which he came to admire passionately for its religious and political freedom and the general air of tolerance that he felt prevailed there. Soon after coming back from that exile to France, Voltaire is in hot water again, this time for publishing a savage indictment of the entire system of government in France, a work called The Philosophical Letters. Philosophical Letters. And in response to this work, the authorities, believe it or not, decreed that the book should be burned publicly by a hangman, and a warrant should be issued for the author's arrest and imprisonment once again. But Voltaire was a little cleverer than the authorities this time round. He prudently sought sanctuary in a place called Lorraine, an independent duchy outside, beyond the French border and beyond the reach of the French authorities. And he lived there in a place called Siri with his beloved mistress of the time, the Marquise du Châtelet, from 1733 right through to 1749. There is the marquise in the upper picture there, and there below is the house that they occupied, Les Délices, the delights. In 1749, alas, the marquise died, and Voltaire moved away from Lorraine to the court of Frederick the Great in Germany. And there he stayed from 1750 to 53, but typically of Voltaire, another ill-advised quarrel with a highly placed adversary forces him to seek refuge, this time in Switzerland. And he spends basically the rest of his life in Switzerland, in this lovely house called Les Délices, which is near Geneva. And it's there, living in that house, that he wrote the majority of the text that we've been reading, Candide. And he later on moved to a place called Ferney, just over the border with France, and devoted himself for the rest of his life after Candide to writing in support of a variety of liberal causes, opposing the tyranny and persecution being inflicted on the French population by both the French Church and the French state. Voltaire became, in his later years, in effect, one of the great public critics of the religious and political oppression going on in his native country in the years leading up to the French Revolution, the end of that century. He's certainly one of the precursors of that enormous event. Now, while he was living in Les Délices, in relative comfort and relative security, something happened which turned Voltaire's entire world upside down. 9:30 a.m. on All Souls Day, November the 1st, 1755, a massive earthquake centered about 200 kilometers out in the Atlantic Ocean, hit one of the most beautiful and the most prosperous cities of the time in Europe, namely Lisbon, the capital of Portugal and center of the thriving Portuguese Empire. With its 275,000 inhabitants, the city was one of the largest in the world at the time, and it still preserved traces of Moorish influence in its magnificent architecture. But over a 10-minute period, on that terrible morning, it endured three huge jolts, which modern seismologists tell us would have registered very, very close to 9 on the modern Richter scale. So it was a much bigger earthquake even than the San Francisco quake of 1906. And the devastation that followed was absolutely appalling, as was the loss of life. In the mass destruction caused by the quake and by three huge tidal waves, tsunamis, which were over 50 feet high, you can imagine. 50 feet high, a wall of water that high engulfed the city. And more than 60,000 people were killed in that short period of time. And the entire city was reduced to rubble. Here are a few contemporary woodcuts and etchings showing this terrible event. And some of them include, you can see, tidal wave. You can see the tremendous waves coming in and flooding the city. And if all that wasn't enough, as in San Francisco, a massive fire broke out in the aftermath of the earthquake and raged through what was left of the city for another 5 days. And in at least one of these, you can see the fire and the smoke coming up from that. Now, just to give you an idea of the devastation in addition to these slides, here are, oops, wrong, sorry. Here are some of the buildings as they were left after the earthquake. There you have on the top left the Church of St. Nicholas, complete ruin. On the right top, the Patriarchal Palace. On the bottom, the wonderful Opera House in Lisbon. And on the right-hand bottom side, the cathedral. It was an absolute disaster, a terrible catastrophe. Now, Europe hadn't witnessed a catastrophe on this kind of scale since the Great Plague of 1348, the so-called Black Death, which decimated the population of Europe. And this brings me to the great central issue that Voltaire is exploring here in Candide. Namely, how can it be that an omnipotent and a benevolent God would be governing the world and permit this kind of event to take place? The Great Lisbon Earthquake, in other words, raised in its most extreme form the philosophical problem that had vexed both Christians and non-Christians for well over 1,000 years, the problem of evil. How, as I say, could an all-powerful, how could a loving God have permitted such a terrible thing to happen? The Greek philosopher Epicurus put this very, very nicely several centuries before the birth of Christ, when some very bad things were going on as well, as you've heard from Professor McCall. And Epicurus asked these questions that I've got up here on the screen. Is God willing to prevent evil, but not able to? Then, if that's the case, then he is not omnipotent. Is he able to prevent evil, but not willing to? Then he is not benevolent. Is he neither willing nor able to prevent evil? Then, if he's not omnipotent and benevolent, then he is not God, because those are his characteristics of God. Is he both willing and able to prevent evil? Whence then comes evil? Whence comes evil? Generations of philosophers and Christian theologians have wrestled desperately with this question, long, long before Voltaire and his contemporaries confronted it. And it would take quite literally an entire course to examine the various solutions that they proposed. But broadly speaking, it seems to me, the solutions they came up with can be broken down into three major schools of thought, all of which were still being vigorously debated in 18th century Europe. The first of them, there at the top, is what we might call the totalist solution. And the totalist solution holds that what we perceive as evil is in reality merely an illusion. An illusion that's created by our very limited and partial perspective on the world. Another name for the solution is the one that Voltaire uses, optimism. And this is how one intellectual historian, modern intellectual historian, summarizes the optimistic or totalist view and solution to the problem of evil. Quote, we judge certain events and or experiences to be evil, and within the limitations of our purview, we appear to be right in so judging. But if we only knew enough, if we could grasp the event that we call evil in all its relations, all its connections, all its consequences, within the totality of all events, then we would see that our judgment is incorrect. That the event that we thought was evil, in fact, makes a necessary and ineluctable contribution to the goodness, the harmony, and the beauty of the whole, of the totality. Now, perhaps the classic statement of this solution is found in a work by a great and influential Christian theologian who lived about 100 years before Boethius, namely Saint Augustine of Hippo. There is a portrait of him, or a picture of him, in his study on the right-hand side on the screen. He wrote a work called The City of God early in the 5th century, in which he said that there are certain heretics, as we'll see in a moment, he's thinking of the Manichaean sect, there are certain heretics who deny the goodness of the creation, quote, on the grounds that many things in it are unsuitable and harmful to that poor and fragile mortality of the flesh to men and women. The heretics mention, for instance, fire, cold, wild beasts, disease, earthquakes, floods, and things like that, without considering how wonderful such things are in themselves and in their proper place, and how beautifully they fit into the total pattern of the universe, making, as it were, their particular contributions to a commonwealth, a totality of cosmic beauty. And then he has a very, very famous simile that Voltaire picks up on in Candide. For as the beauty of a picture is not dimmed by dark colors and shadows in their proper place, so the beauty of the universe of creatures, if one only has the insight to discern it, is not marred by evil, even though evil itself is an ugly blotch taken on its own. The trouble with a person, he concludes, the trouble with a person who does not see the whole is that he is offended by the ugliness of a part because he does not know its context or its relation to the whole. So that's the totalist or the optimistic solution to the problem of evil. Evil is just an illusion produced by our rather narrow and particular and partial view of life. The second solution is the dualistic solution to the problem that originally was propounded by Augustine's opponents, a religious sect called the Manichees, way back in the 3rd and 4th centuries of our era. Now, according to the Manichees, the coexistence of good and evil in the world was attributable to the coexistence of two rival gods. One malign and destructive, a kind of cosmic Herman Hodges, the other benign and creative. And this world, the Manichees believed, was largely, though not entirely, under the control of the evil deity, who disfigured it with such terrible phenomena as disease, famine, drought, floods, and so on. Every other imaginable kind of human and natural disaster. The good deity, the good God, on the other hand, was responsible for all the positive aspects of our world. But unfortunately, he was not sufficiently powerful to defeat his wicked adversary. And as a result, human life is a bewildering mixture of good and evil, pleasure and pain, health and sickness. And that brings me to the third solution to the problem of evil. And that is the monotheistic Christian solution, based on the first three chapters of Genesis, on the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1 through 3. The so-called doctrine of the fall of man. And according to this doctrine, Satan's original rebellion against God in heaven and Adam and Eve's act of disobedience in the Garden of Eden permanently disfigured the original perfection of the human race and of the natural world that they inhabited. As Milton put it in his great epic on the fall of man, Paradise Lost, it was the fruit of the forbidden tree that brought, quote, death into the world and all our woe, unquote. So according to this view, then, God originally intended his creation to be in every way ideal. But egged on by the devil, disguised as a serpent, his first creatures, Adam and Eve, abused the free will that he had given them to pervert and distort that world by eating the forbidden fruit. So according to Christianity in this period, the evil god of the Manichees, the malign and evil deity of the Manichees, was in reality no more than a fallen angel, Satan, Lucifer, who had deceived himself into believing that he was the equal of God, and who, after he failed to supplant God during the war in heaven, devoted himself for all eternity to despoiling God's creation. Now, the first of these three theories, the totalist theory, was particularly prominent in the 18th century, and particularly popular thanks to the labors of a great German philosopher called Leibniz. And you all should be grateful to Leibniz because he invented calculus. He's the inventor of calculus. But he was a great, great philosopher, as well as a mathematician. And he wrote a book and published it in 1710 called The Theodicy. Remember that word from discussion of Boethius. Theodicy from Theos, God, Dike, Justice. It's a demonstration or an attempt at a demonstration of the justice of God. And one of Leibniz's most famous disciples was the great 18th century English poet I mentioned before, Alexander Pope, who summed up the whole optimistic or totalist theory as follows in a poem that Voltaire knew extremely well, a poem called The Essay on Man, back in 1733 before. And this is how Pope sums it all up. He says, "All nature is but art, unknown to thee. All chance, direction, which thou canst not see." You can see the echoes of Boethian thinking there. "All discord, harmony, not understood. All partial evil, universal good." Very nice, neat summary of the optimistic view. Now, another of Leibniz's followers, as it happened, was Voltaire's mistress, Madame the Marquise du Châtelet. And thanks to her, Voltaire seems, for a period in his life at least, to have actually flirted with the totalist theory while he was living with his mistress, the Marquise, in Syrie. In 1738-9, for example, he wrote a work called The Seven Discourses on Man. You can see there at the bottom of the list. And that work was modelled directly on Pope's essay on man that I just quoted to you and propounded exactly the same basic philosophy. And in the work that I've also listed there, Zadi, a few years later, he did just the same thing. But the Lisbon earthquake, 16 years later, changed everything in Voltaire's mental universe. In the earthquake, in that earthquake year, he published rapidly a poem called On the Disaster at Lisbon. And in that poem, he bitterly ridicules the attempts of philosophers like Leibniz to explain away such disasters on the ground that they were indispensable elements in a total composition whose beauty and harmony were ordained by just and benevolent providence. This is how one scholar sums up Voltaire's poem on the earthquake, the disaster of Lisbon. He says, the poem's conclusions are simple, its philosophy not very deep, and it's this. Catastrophe raises directly the question of good and evil. What must one think of it? Admit two principles, like the Manichaeans, believe that in the long run everything is good, like the totalists? No. The optimism of Pope and Leibniz is nothing but a discouraging fatalism. Physical and moral reality give it the lie. To go about telling the miserable victims of Lisbon that everything is well and conforms to the universal reason is to make a mockery of them, to show oneself absolutely incapable of any human feeling, and in particular of any pity or compassion. Now that angry poem by Voltaire, his first reaction to the Lisbon earthquake, that poem inspired another famous French writer of the time, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, to counter Voltaire's arguments in a work called A Letter on Providence, which he published in 1756. And in that work, Rousseau reaffirmed the old optimistic view of the totalists. God, he said, is not to blame, absolutely not. On the contrary, evil is the result of man's living in crowded cities when he should be living naturally and safely out in the countryside. That was Rousseau's theory about why this terrible event had happened. Indeed, he said, there may have been individuals in Lisbon to whom sudden death was a blessing in disguise. In any event, he said, providence works not for the benefit of this or that individual, but rather through general laws, as Pope had said, to which we must reverentially submit. Now, Candide, that was written in 1758 and published the next year in 1759. Candide, Rousseau firmly believed, was in fact a reply to Rousseau's letter. And it, I suppose, is possible if we can't prove it one way or the other. But whether or not Rousseau was right about that, there's no denying the fact, I think, that the book is a wonderfully, wonderfully effective satirical rebuttal of the optimistic or totalist theory. And the rebuttal works in a perfectly simple, straightforward way. It's not very intellectually sophisticated. Voltaire introduces a spokesman for the optimistic position, a ridiculous old philosopher called Pangloss, whose name, as I'm sure you learned, means all tongue in Greek, Pangloss. And whenever Pangloss is confronted with some appalling instance of human suffering, even if it's his own suffering, He responds with the quintessential optimistic totalist assertion that all is for the best, in the best of all possible worlds. But then, as the book progresses, and as the horrors that Pangloss and his student Condé witness and undergo, as they become increasingly unendurable, the sheer absurdity of any attempt to apply the totality theory to actual, concrete, individual instances of human suffering emerges all too clearly. Pangloss's sheer indifference to the pain of his fellow men and women, and let it be said, to his own pain, comes to seem finally inhuman, it seems to me. But on the other hand, one could also argue that there is something rather heroic, if not admirable, about Pangloss's unswerving loyalty to Leibniz's philosophy. Because unlike Candide, his student, who, as we'll see in a moment, oscillates violently and constantly back and forth between optimism one moment and pessimism the next moment, depending entirely on what his most recent experience has been like, Pangloss never for a moment allows his recognition of the tragic here and now to shape his fundamental faith in Leibniz's arguments. And his irrepressible optimism comes to seem, to me at least, finally, almost, perhaps not quite, but almost noble. "Now, my dear Pangloss," says Candide at the end of chapter 28, "now, my dear Pangloss, tell me this. When you had been hanged, dissected, and beaten unmercifully, and while you were rowing at your bench in the galley, did you still think that everything in the world is for the best?" "I still hold my original views," replied Pangloss, "for I am still a philosopher. It would not be proper for me to recant, especially as Leibniz cannot be wrong. Besides, the pre-established harmony, together with the plenum and the materia subtilis," these are all catchphrases for Leibniz's theodicy, "those things are the most beautiful things in the world." So Pangloss is one of those individuals who refuses to compromise, who refuses absolutely to reach any accommodation with actual circumstances. He is, if you like, an idealist, obstinately reaffirming his faith every time it seems to be irresistibly overcome by the terrible facts of human existence. He may well be stubborn. He may well be unfeeling. But I think, personally, it is hard not to feel at least a little twinge of sympathy for him. It's what makes him such a great character. So, as all this may suggest to you, and with this I think I'll finish a little bit early today, as all this may suggest, I think, you need to think long and hard before characterizing Candide as an unqualified attack on the optimistic view of things. In addition to what I just said about Pangloss, for example, we need to take into account the fact that the deity that's described in Candide, is in fact, in all essentials, the deity of the optimistic hero. Sa Hautesse, His Highness, as Voltaire calls him. And His Highness, we learn, is completely unconcerned with the plight of his creatures. As the dervish puts it towards the end of the book on page 141, what if there is a great deal of evil in the world? When His Highness, Sa Hautesse, sends a ship to Egypt, do you suppose he worries whether the ship's mice are comfortable or not? So that deity, it seems to me, is exactly the deity that Leibniz and Pope have described. The deity who sees with equal eye as God of all, in Pope's words, a hero perish or a sparrow fall. He just doesn't care. So that's a second consideration to take into account. And what I'll do next time is suggest to you that the narrator, the voice that is narrating this story, also embodies this uncaring, indifferent narrator, indifferent God. And that the narrator is, if you like, a human incarnation of that uncaring, detached, indifferent God. And insofar as that voice belongs to Voltaire, we can say that Voltaire too is writing from the optimistic position. We'll talk about that in detail next time. Thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.